for nothing else, the story alone, the tiny nation of Iceland have qualified, as you saw it here, with a 0-0 draw at home to Kazakhstan.
How about a little bit more excitement for that, Fox? Iceland qualify, Holland struggling, a review of the transfer window, and so, so much more. European Football Weekly starts right now. Wait till the beat go
in. Despite all the efforts, the Dutch simply haven't had enough penetration and enough quality to undo this very resilient and determined Turkish team, epitomised by Caner Erkin. And can they seal it here with Burak Yilmaz? It's three! Turkey with three goals to go into third place. And how the mighty are falling.
How the mighty are falling. Can you believe it? The Netherlands might not make Euro 2016 in France, Thomas.
Yeah, I don't know what to say. This is the easiest tournament to qualify for. So if Netherlands are knocked out, there's a huge, huge problem.
Clearly you're wrong. This is apparently not the easiest tournament to qualify for, even though they expanded it to 24 teams. That's right. European Football Weekly is on the air. Sportsnet 590 The Fan. I am Dan Riccio. That is Thomas Michalakos. You can follow us on the Twitters at EFW. No, that's no longer in service.
Oh,
that's no longer in service. Never
so
mind.
So used to saying it.
So used to saying it. At Dan Riccio 590 and at Unfit Ref. And you want to follow along with the hashtag EFW 590. You can do so as well. So I actually, yesterday, I was watching the game here at Sportsnet while on the sports desk, and Holland's getting their heads kicked in by Turkey.
Thoroughly heads kicked in.
Thoroughly kicked in. And I get a question from Andrew on Twitter, and he says, are the Netherlands finished?
No.
No, they're not finished?
No, because they're playing Kazakhstan, I believe, next. So there's a 3 points right there.
They are at Kazakhstan and versus the Czech Republic at home in Holland. Those are their last two matches in the group. They have to at least finish third. They trail Turkey by 2 points for third in this group. And they can no longer get an automatic qualifying spot, which is currently held by Iceland and the Czech Republic. Both are qualified.
Yeah, so they're definitely playing a playoff. That's 100%, and that's the bare minimum.
Yeah, and Turkey has to play at the Czech Republic and against Iceland. So both those teams are already qualified. Really just kind of battling for first or second are the Czechs and Iceland. And I should mention James Montague, author of 31-0. He's been on the show before. He is going to join us and talk about Iceland's rise, really, to become one of the prominent countries in European football, at least right now. And maybe it's more than just a golden generation thing with Iceland. So we'll talk to him about that. But Holland, this is a team that was just in the semifinals of the World Cup just over a year ago, Tom.
That's why that phrase works so well. The mighty have fallen.
Yeah.
Say goodbye.
It's not funny. Say goodbye just yet. Come
it's,
on.
It's funny that that Borat made a comment because they are headed to, oh no, they're playing at home against Kazakhstan.
Yeah.
Wow. I'm still amazed that this team is this bad.
So they've already been through two coaches since Louis van Gaal left.
So there's the first thing.
For greener pastures at Manchester United. Now Danny Blind is the coach. His son Daley Blind isn't playing quite well right now, at least for country, not so much. And you look at the squad that went to the World Cup. Memphis Depay was there. Huntelaar was there. Dirk Kuyt. Jermaine Lenz, Robin Van Persie, there's your strikers. Jordy Klaassen, he's injured right now. They could certainly use him. Jonathan de Guzman, Nigel de Jong, Leroy Fair, Arjen Robben, Wesley Sneijder, Georgino Wijnaldum, Daley Blind, Joel Veltman, Steven de Vrij, Daryl Janmaat.
Sounds great to me so far.
Terrence Kongolo, Bruno Martins Indy, Paul Verhaeg, Ron Vlaar, Jasper Cillessen, Tim Krul, and Michael Vorm were the keepers. What is going on with Holland right now? Like, the team isn't that much different right now.
No, and on paper, you look at that, and look at the list of amazing, like, I'm not even going to say amazing, but formidable players on that squad. There's no rhyme or reason for it, and I spoke to you earlier about this when we're doing our show prep. I look at it and go, you know, you got the old guys, the old guard, the veteran leaders have been there. You got your Van Persie's, your Robins, your, you know, Schneiders.
Yep.
But then the gap falls. Like, you look at players like Depay and Wijnaldum, and those are the future. They're there, but they're not ready to take this team and lead it to the standards of what, you know, Dutch fans are expected. They expect to roll through the group stages, win every game, barely allow a goal, score 50, 60 goals in the thing. We see it all the time.
Yeah.
But I just think there's just that gap there where the young blood's not ready and the old guard just has to let go.
Yeah, you look at their defending right now. The oldest player is Gregory van der Veel. He is 27. The oldest player on the team is Robin van Persie. He's 32, along with Klaas-Jan Huntelaar and Wesley Sneijder.
There's a huge gap in age.
31. Everybody else is pretty young on this Dutch team, which we've kind of, you know,
they roll along. It kind of goes over, and you know, it doesn't matter what generation, we find the new players and they all do well, but it has to be that, because it cannot be just the players, because that roster is amazing.
Yeah, and Mike tweeted into me and he says, "Come on, Dan, they are one of the biggest pretenders around. Need a lot to go their way. We'll likely get a win away to Kazakhstan, but that home match against the Czechs might be trouble, though Czech already in. Will be exciting."
See, I don't get that, how they're overrated, and you know, because they're
It's Holland.
They're always the bridesmaid, never the bride, yet they're good enough to be there.
They destroy qualifying every single time.
Every single tournament.
And here's my point of contention with that, Mike. And it's nothing against you, but you know, like, we're forgetting this team just made the World Cup semifinals. Although a lot of people back then, I remember, because I was one of them, that wasn't surprised that they made a nice long run at the World Cup.
The way they did it was surprising.
Because they did it with defense.
Yeah.
And this is a team that is still the most talented team in this group. Yes, Iceland is a nice story. Yes, they have some nice players. The Czechs, they're always kind of in that weird tier of, we're going to make some tournaments, we're not going to make other ones, we'll get some good players in and out type of deal. But Holland is, bar none, the most talented squad in this Group A of European qualifying.
Except in one position, and it's always has been a problem since Van der Sar has left. They do not have a goalie. And you could say what you want about Tim Krul.
What do you mean? They figure out who's going to take penalties and who's going to play the game.
That alone was... I mean, you got to do what you got to do to win. I get that. But when you can't stand on the shoulders of your goalkeeper, there's a problem there. And I don't think they've had anyone in that's remotely close to the confidence that Van der Sar gave to the team. And Cillessen is awful in my books.
Yeah, and Andrew says, "We keep giving respect, quotes, because they're the Dutch, but you have to start looking what's on the pitch right now. Hashtag not good. 10 points from 8 games, and World Cup amnesia starts settling in real fast. Looking forward to listening to the show tomorrow." Well, you're listening to it now. So thank you for the tweet, Andrew, and we appreciate it every time that you do. Hashtag EFW590 if you want to join in on the conversation. And Holland, very much in doubt to be at Euro 2016. And often we
they'll be there.
They will be there. But often we can look at these things, and we know it was a big thing for the Germans when they struggled in the late 90s and early 2000s with their team, and how the struggles of the national team really brought on some revolution in how they went about doing things and how they went about developing players.
But how do you revolutionize a system that just breeds excellence all the time? Like, they have everything. Have you ever been to Holland?
No,
they have everything. They have the pitches for the
You've
kids.
You've been to Ajax?
I've been to Ajax. I did a tour of the stadium and all their academy and everything. You have to walk a pretty far away from Amsterdam Arena to get to the stadium.
Is it as cool as I think it is?
It's amazing. I even had lunch inside where the academy and everything play. It's unreal. So it has nothing to do with grassroots development. It's there. It's just a time thing. And it's just not a good time for Dutch football internationally.
It's a point of a transition, I guess, is the best way to put it.
Better word.
They're certainly not the only team that is in transition. We look at teams like Italy, who's really struggled in this qualifying stage, and they don't look anything like, you know, the Euro 2012 finalists that they were. This is a team that has kind of really been struggling to find a new group of young talent. And I can say that because I look at this squad and I'm like, being, you know, Italo-Canadian, I'm like, who the hell are these guys?
You know what's funny, though, is you sit there and you complain, but, you know, Italy's top of the group, 5 wins, 3 draws after 8 games. I'm Greek-Canadian, and what can I say about transition right now? That is probably by far one of the worst teams I've ever seen on the pitch. Although they did play well in their 1-0 loss, this is awful. And all these teams are in transition. Bosnia is another one where they have 11 points or 2 points, I believe, out of the third place. And, you know, you really want to see them get through because they've done so well to get there.
Yeah.
Right? So there's a lot of things, and it's just amazing to me that it's so easy to get in. It's so easy. And yet, these teams are struggling.
Well, joining us right now is James Montague, formerly mentioned. And
Perfect timing.
You know, so our producer, Emil Delic, just whispered in my ear, he's living there. And I'm assuming you're living in Holland right now, James?
I am, yeah. I got the first thing that happened when I got here, you know, Iceland go and win 1-0. So good time to get here.
Yeah, and I imagine it's kind of pandemonium. Everybody wants everybody fired, and everybody's wondering why this Dutch team is struggling so mightily. What are the newspapers and the radio stations and the television saying in Holland right now?
Well, obviously it's a huge embarrassment, and everybody's going crazy about the result. But obviously, they're not going to sack the coach. I mean, the Iceland game was the first game in charge, and Turkey was the second game in charge. So. They're stuck with Blinter for a few months yet. But, on TV afterwards, you could see after the Iceland result, it was just absolute shell shock. Robin was, he just couldn't explain it. The coach looked like he was, the coach looked like he'd had 40 cigarettes before the end of the game. He looked kind of exhausted, hungover, ruined. It was, it was a real wake-up call. And I think they expected it to be fairly... like the World Cup qualification group for 2014, it was going to be a walkover. Whatever happened, it was going to be an easy qualification. That's what a lot of the talk was with 2016 European Championship qualification anyway, that these groups were so easy. They'd been set up for the big teams to always qualify. Maybe they believed the hype. What's happened is the exact opposite. It's given the smaller teams, and in particular the mid-ranking teams. I think that's the big thing. It's the mid-ranking teams who now have a motivation because of the playoff place to get, in third place, to really, deep into qualification, to have actually, to be competitive and actually have, even Estonia, look at Estonia. I think they drew with San Marino, and if that hadn't happened, they'd have been in for a shout at these final few games. And you think, well, that's been the beauty of it. Everyone thought that European Championship qualification for 2016 would be the end of the minnows, would be the death of the underdog. And actually, it's revived them. It's given them, a carrot rather than this massive stick of continual beating that they were getting before. And I think it's been wonderful. And I think it's an accidental byproduct. I've got no doubt that that this wasn't an intended byproduct of Platini's reforms to the qualification process. But, for somebody who's written a book about international football minnows and who loves, as everybody does, an underdog story, I think it's been one of the most interesting campaigns I can remember for a long time, if not ever.
Now, me and Dan were going back and forth trying to figure out what the actual problem is, because on paper you look at that team and it's brilliant. Now, is it a Danny Blind thing, tactical changes, formation, or is it more a generation thing where the development of the team, the old guys are too far off and the young guys are not ready to pick up the slack?
Who knows? He's a good coach. You've got to think they were, they had a great World Cup campaign. It was an unexpected World Cup campaign with Van Gaal, and I think it obviously gave one of my favourite ever World Cup moments, which is the Tim Krul incident when they brought him in for the penalty shootout. This isn't particularly a team in transition. They have these moments where the squads fall out and. Previously, there was always whether that was something that had a racial element to it. I don't think that's a problem anymore within Dutch football. I think it's impossible to put your finger on it. That's a supremely talented side. But sometimes the players don't gel. And it's something that, if anything, I'm a lot more familiar with the England national team, that sometimes a team isn't, better than the sum of its parts. It's worse. And sometimes it needs a coach to come in and say, maybe we don't need so many of these superstar players. Actually, what works best is you know, maybe an overlooked player, maybe a Moneyball type experiment of international football, looking at the overlooked players. But I don't think anybody can put their finger on it. I think everybody here thought that it was after the World Cup that was, you know, Dutch players, Dutch coaches were in high stock. You know, that this would this would be a walkover. It wasn't a particularly... I mean, anybody who's watched anything of international football would know that Iceland aren't the team to be taken lightly. But from what you saw in Holland after the defeat, it was as if they'd been beaten by Martians. You know, it was like they hadn't done their homework. They hadn't worked out. And what was interesting watching that game is how technically good Iceland were. You know, they were the team playing away from home, but they were I didn't see a stray pass. Yeah. You know, from the Iceland team. And that's because, I mean, we were talking a little bit on before we came on air about how technically proficient they've become because of the revolution that's happened within Icelandic football. And when you think the population is 300,000, which is, you know, I mean, they're, you know, Dutch cities that are...
exactly.
That size. So it's, you know, I mean, they're all shell-shocked. Yeah, I suspect they'll still get, you know, I think it's Czech Republic and Turkey.
Yeah.
Next, and I suspect they'll probably get what they need to get, and they'll, you know. But I mean, it's looking like there could be some very big sides in that draw, you know, for the
playoff,
the playoffs. And I just hope they don't seed them. I have to check. I don't know whether they're seeding them or not, but that is my pet hate with playoffs, seeding playoffs. I can't stand it because the seeding has already taken place to draw the groups. And then it's your performance after that. And if you're not good enough to finish in the first two, then you shouldn't then be given, you know, a plum draw in the playoff. I mean, it should just be an open draw.
Yeah, the big sides get every advantage in these qualifying stages for sure. That's the voice of James Montague. You may have heard him on the BBC World Football Show. You may have seen his book around 31-0. And in that book, James, you have a chapter actually about Iceland and how they've flipped around the script on their country and how they play football and how they've developed. We saw them get ever so close to qualifying for the World Cup. It didn't happen, but now this time around, they've qualified for their first ever major tournament. So what was the turning point for the Icelandic FA, and how did they make this become an annual thing where they're really competing in these qualifying tournaments?
Well, I mean, the big change, and when, you know, I went over there to Norway was the first time I actually had kind of exposure to Icelandic football, and it was talking to Lars Lagerbäck and talking to some of the FA development guys. And the big thing for them was that they could only play football half of the year. The weather was so terrible in Iceland. Obviously, I mean, it's called Iceland, so obviously it gets very cold in the winter. So one of the big things they decided to institute was reform of indoor football halls. So they had top quality indoor football halls. So kids were playing football all year round. And then on top of that, they decided that they wanted to have the highest quality coaches coaching these young kids from the youngest possible age. And that's what they did. They put their money where their mouth is. And there's a really great, because Raphael Honigstein's just written a new book about German football, and it was just excerpted in an excerpt of it in The Guardian. And this is the kind of conversations that the Germans were having. You know, after their disastrous end of the 90s, beginning of the noughties football period. And that's exactly what they've done. They've invested in coaching, in youth, making sure that every young Icelandic kid, you know, is only a few miles away from being able to play football all year long. But then most importantly, after that, what's interesting is that there's a lot of kind of prejudice about, you know, you've got to have a strong national league. You know, the English have got that. You've got to have a strong national league, you know, and kind of if your players go abroad, in a way, it's kind of like, you know, the league isn't good enough. You know, you need to have a strong national league. What the Icelandics have said is that we're never going to have a strong national league. We're never going to have a league that competes with the best in Europe. You know, if any of our clubs get into even the qualifying rounds or further in the qualifying rounds of UEFA or Champions League, then, you know, that's a great thing to have happened. But, you know, they realise that those players, once they've got to the age of 16, 17 years old, where, you know, they've kind of outgrown the league, they move them straight away to really, you know, good standard of league play, whether it's in Holland or Denmark or, I mean, Turkey even, the Championship in the UK and England. You know, and then in Premier League itself, so you have, you know, they're not prissy about it. They're not like, they're not kind of offended by saying that the Icelandic league isn't good enough. They realise that the real competitive football education takes place in those places, and those players have been good enough to play at that level. And I'm so happy for Icelandic football and the fans, because the away fans are absolutely brilliant. I mean, I remember the Norway game, when probably the finest fans ever met was this guy called Arne, who's a massive beast of a guy. And he had a massive beard and horned helmet, and he was just crying on me, you know. And I remember recording it for a BBC thing, and he was just crying. It was so emotional, and I just felt so sorry when they didn't make it to the World Cup. And yeah. This guy's just been messaging me about, you know, increasingly drunken texts about what he's getting up to in Reykjavik. And, you know, this is just a huge moment for not just for Icelandic football, but for Iceland as a country. And I think that's when international football is at its best, when it can really bring a country together and engender that kind of pride in a country. And I think that's kind of quite an unfashionable thing to talk about, is connecting what the origins of international football are to kind of how it makes people feel about where they're from. And I think that it's wonderful to see. And I don't think they're going to go to Euro 2016 to make up the numbers. You know, they could actually go quite deep in that tournament, I think. I mean, if they get a favorable draw.
Yeah. Well, we look at it, and you were mentioning the, you know, the National League is not that great, and I'm looking at it right now, and they're 35th in UEFA's coefficient ranking. Moldova, Liechtenstein, even Kazakhstan and Azerbaijan are ahead of the Icelandic League in UEFA coefficient ranking.
Kazakhstan's got a team in the Champions League
this year. Of course they do, but it's, you know, it's not going to my point right now, Dan.
But if you look at Kazakhstan, Azerbaijan, I mean, they've thrown so much money.
Yeah.
At football, you know, they're resource rich, you know, former Soviet, you know, satellite states. They've got money. They've invested it heavily in sport, in hosting events, and in their football teams, and getting coaches in as well. They don't do it in the same way. And I think this is what's interesting about Iceland is when I spoke to Lars Lagerbäck, who's then the only coach, but now is kind of a, you know, there's two coaches there at the Iceland national team, and he said, you know, one of the things I wanted to come to Iceland to do, the reason I wanted to come to Iceland is I like the way that Icelandic people organize their society, you know, how their work ethic, the way that people say, okay, it's a very collectivist, I know it's not Scandinavian, but kind of Scandinavian type kind of mentality. And obviously Lars is back in Swedish, so he kind of recognize that. And I think that's what it is. It's everybody pulling together. And there's not a lot of them, so I guess it might be easier to organize a country of 300,000 to do that. But everybody is pulling together in the same direction. And I think every single small nation has to look at Iceland and say, you know, this is the blueprint that we've got to follow. This is what we've got to do. This is how we have to do it. And, you know, at 330,000, I mean, there aren't many countries smaller than Iceland. I don't think if they ever get to the World Cup, I don't think the record would ever be broken of them being the smallest country to ever get to the World Cup. So the argument that a lot of people make about minnows, and then we had this with San Marino in England, that there's, you know, you can't have these teams playing, you need to have pre-qualification. I mean, before the 2014 World Cup, Iceland were in pot, I think it was pot five, in the same pot as San Marino for the draw. You know, and Iceland were one of the worst teams in Europe, one of the worst teams in the world a few years ago, I mean, just 10 years ago. So you see, for me, that, you know, this is a prime example of why we should always keep the smaller teams, and because it's bigger, international football is bigger than just who's the best and who's the worst. I think it's more important, and it appeals to something deeper and more interesting than just, you know, what's good and what's bad.
James Montague, our guest, author of 31-0, and if you haven't read it yet, you definitely need to go out there and get it. It's a fantastic read. James, one thing I want to make note of with Iceland, and you know, every time I look at their current squad, I'm kind of shocked to see that Eider Gudjonsson is still on that squad. Dwayne De Rosario was kind of the one guy here in Canada that in recent years we've looked to and kind of hoped that he would be something like a symbol for young players to kind of look at and say, hey, I can be that guy. I can move on and play professional soccer, because we've obviously had that struggle here in Canada as well with getting our national team to more prominent places. But has Eider Gudjonsson been that type of a player for Iceland? And can you really look at him as having some sort of impact on Iceland's regrouping here?
Well, I think for a long while he was when he was playing at Chelsea, he was the star of Icelandic football, and he was kind of carrying that team and playing for that national team when it was getting hammered, when it was a terrible team. So of course he's been an incredibly important player, and he obviously, I mean, he's not as young as he used to be, and after he was kind of brought back in to the squad in 2014 when their campaign was faltering a little bit, and he brought a little bit of experience, a little bit of maturity. I mean, it's a very young side, so he had experience playing football at the very highest level. So he's a hugely totemic figure within Icelandic football, and actually he retired after 2014 because he thought that was going to be the end. And I was there in Croatia outside the Maximar Stadium. He was in tears. Lars Lagerbäck was devastated. They come so close. I mean, you know, Croatia were down to 10 men. It was there for the taking, and they didn't take it, and they were absolutely devastated. And I thought that would be the last we ever see of Idagard Johnson in an Icelandic shirt. But he was persuaded to come back, and when he came on, you could tell he had that. He still has that ability. I mean, he's never going to beat anybody for pace, but you know, he's a very intelligent player, very intelligent forward. And, you know, so he's absolutely, and it's such a great story that he is going to be at the Euro 2016. I mean, and I don't think that's going to be the end of the good Johnsons either, because, I mean, if you remember, the great fact is he made his debut for Iceland, replacing his father as a substitute. And I think his son plays for the under-17 Iceland team as well. And that's another thing you've got to remember, is that the Iceland team are doing fantastically well at every youth group.
Yeah.
I think that's the true imprimatur of quality of what's going on there, is that the under-20s, under-21s, under-17s, you know, Iceland are beating more established teams that have got far more established youth teams set up. So, yeah, but, I mean, who knows? I mean, you could have Idagard Johnson being replaced by his son, and then you've got, I mean, I don't think that'd ever be beaten. A grandfather, a father and a son all replacing each other. You know, within 15 years, I think that'd be incredible.
That would be one of the greatest stories. And right now, yeah. Iceland is one of the greatest stories in world football, and you've been on it for quite some time, James. And thank you for joining us and shedding some light on this, because we hadn't really known what has been behind Iceland's kind of rise here in European football. And it's a pleasure having you on, and keep doing what you're doing, because it's a... it's fascinating, some of the stuff that you put out there for us to read on.
I hope Canada takes some interest in what Iceland are doing, because, you know, a country that size, you know, it should be doing far better, you know. And I think there are similar, we're talking before we came on air, I think there are some similar issues about weather and how to get the best out of players. I know there's a lot more competition for sports in Canada, but, you know, I mean, Canada should look to Iceland and work out what they're doing and really just copy it word for word.
Hey, James, we might refer you to the Canadian Soccer Association to help them out. And all the stuff that you've learned on your travels, you might be able to give a helping hand to the Canadian Soccer Association, who hasn't really been able to figure anything out over the last very number of years. Thanks again, James. We really appreciate it.
Anytime.
And we're actually going to talk about Canadian soccer right now with Daniel Sposato. Yeah, we beat Belize. I just want one thing on you. Are we going to see Iceland pull the Greece?
Well, these are the tournaments. The Euro is the one that brings in all the Denmark won it in 92, Greece 2004.
And, you know, this
Yes, Iceland will win Euro.
I was glad that James brought all that up, because we were worried that it was just this whole expanding of the Euro is just going to water it down and really make it just awful to go through qualifying.
I was a voice for that, yes.
And, you know, so far it hasn't been that way. Like, let's be honest. Like, we're seeing some pretty good performances. Wales has come through. We're seeing Iceland. We've seen Slovakia. We've seen, you know, the Ireland is even...
Northern Ireland, having the five, basically Great Britain, all five teams would be amazing.
And it's fascinating to see that. And we're really happy that it's turned out this way. And we may see some more impressive stuff to come in these Euro 2016 qualifiers. We're going to talk a little bit about Canadian soccer. As you heard James just say, Canada might have something to learn from Iceland. So we're going to talk Canada soccer with Daniel Sposato, and maybe go a little bit over the transfer window before we finish up for the night. Dan Riccio, Thomas Michalakos, European Football Weekly, Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. No medical exam or health questions will be asked. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand.
Now Witzel. De Bruyne moves inside. That's why he's worth the big bucks.
The big money man. That's why he's worth the big bucks. You heard the call. Kevin De Bruyne.
Apparently not, though.
Why?
About the big bucks with Kevin De Bruyne.
Oh, yeah. We'll get to that in just a couple of minutes. Do a little review of the transfer window of sorts here on European Football Weekly. I am Dan Riccio. That is the one, the only Thomas Michalakos.
That was the greatest intro you've ever given me.
I know. It's because you shaved the beard. You just look you look like a new man.
Do I? Nice, fresh, and clean.
Yeah. As Outkast would say, so fresh and so clean, clean.
Another song of your youth?
Maybe.
Maybe.
People don't know the song of my youth. I do that off air. All the singing and rapping and stuff like that.
I really should turn the mic on and let everyone hear it.
Yes. And it's great in so many ways.
Moving on.
Hashtag EFW590. If you want to join in on the show, we are not looking for tweets on what your childhood songs were. But if you want to throw that our way, sure. Why
right.
not?
To the tail end.
At DataReachO590 and at UnfitRef is where you can get us on the Twitter as well. Belgium doing very, very well. They are they actually are the top team in the world, according to FIFA rankings right now. Might be Wales pretty soon. But either way.
Oh, man.
It should be
Wales and
interesting. One team that is not quite at the top or near the top of FIFA rankings is our own country. That is Canada, as we shift from being European Football Weekly for a second to North American Football Weekly with Daniel Squizzato, as you heard us talk with James Montague in the last segment. Thought that there was some takeaways that Canada could maybe put to good use.
Plenty of takeaways, I think.
In the same way that Iceland has really made a name for themselves and how they built their FA and how they've been developing players, maybe Canada can put that into use. So, Daniel Squizzato, is there anything Iceland has done that Canada can learn from?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that any time a team rises up and has success that they didn't previously have, that's an opportunity for Canada to look and take lessons from it. I mean, unfortunately, in Canada, people are more likely to kind of point and laugh and say, oh, well, look how much we suck, and that team is doing well. But I would prefer, and I would hope that, as you say, we could try to take some lessons from these. There was a pretty good story written last year in Vice about the rise of the Icelandic program and a bit of insight as to how they got to where that they are now. And two of the big things were their investment in coaching. They have, in most cases, UEFA-certified coaches everywhere throughout the country, not just the pro clubs, but the youth clubs as well, and an investment in facilities. They have facilities, either artificial turf or indoor facilities, that they can use and that their players can use on a year-round basis so that they can continue to train throughout what is a tough Icelandic season. So, I think those are two big things that we can take away. You know, the coaching one in particular, the number of certified and qualified coaches in this country compared to the number of youth players we have. I don't know what the exact numbers would be, but I would say that, Iceland's ratio would be a heck of a lot higher than ours would be. So that's a good starting point for us to kind of take away as well. I mean, how that would happen, where the money would come from or how we'd be able to implement it, I don't know. But it certainly worked for Iceland to this point.
The Canadian women's team is vastly superior to the men's national program. We've all seen it. The Women's World Cup was great, and it really brought focus to soccer and, Canada and everything. But, I look at the men's team, and to see the players that are playing on this team where they play, I find it that that's where the problem lies. I feel like the country doesn't do enough to get their players, when they're at an age to develop, to the right programs. And that's where I see Iceland is doing that and then some. So can you speak to that a little bit? And when I see Nakajima Farron on the team and he's playing in Malaysia, like, come on, there's got to be a better player that we can put in there, a young guy that we can work. I just find it's just chaos always. Never anything changes.
Sure, but it's interesting that you mentioned the case of Issy Nakajima Farron. Don't forget that he played for two different Canadian clubs last year. He played for Toronto FC and the Montreal Impact, who both kind of booted him around for a very short span of time and then kind of showed him the door. I'm not saying that, you know, a lot of people bristle at the suggestion that Canadian pro clubs have any responsibility to sign or play or develop Canadian players. You know, a lot of fans in Toronto, Montreal, Vancouver will say, you know what, we don't care. We just want we want our club team to do as well as it can wherever the players come from. Whether or not they come from Canada is of no importance to us. And that's fine. But I'm in the minority that thinks the other way. I would rather see, you know, teams sign and develop and take a shot on Canadian players and see where that leads them. And we've seen as the years have gone by, you know, TFC, the Impact, the Whitecaps, the percentage of playing time for Canadians has gone down and down and down. And again, you know, whether that has to do with, you know, upping the quota of Canadian players there, you know, I don't know whether that's the solution. But what you're speaking about is more of the developmental level, and that's kind of been the missing link in the Canadian program over the years, was taking these vast numbers, hundreds of thousands of youth players that we have, and getting them at that key time and getting them into better pro environments in that kind of, you know, 18 to 21 age bracket where players are hopefully finding their way into pro environments. In a lot of cases, Canadian kids have fallen through the cracks. But luckily, what's happening in Canada is we've got high-performance leagues starting up. There's one, there's PLSQ in Quebec, which has been running for a few years. There's League One Ontario in Ontario, and there's been talk about one coming up in BC as well. And that's a league where a player like Kyle Larin for Orlando City, who's, you know, going to be Rookie of the Year, he's one of the top scorers in the league. He played for a stretch of time last year in making that transition from the college game to the pro game. And players have gone from that league to situations in other countries as well. So that's kind of something along the path to finally bridging that gap. And just quickly, because you mentioned the women's national team, the popular narrative is that the women's team is great and the men's team is garbage. I would say that the women's team has benefited from two things. One, Christine Sinclair, and two, a very small pool of opposition over the last decade and a half. I would say, though, that if we get complacent and think, well, the women's team is always great, there's a good chance that they're going to fall as far behind as the men's team has. So the system as a whole has to work for both the women's and the men's side going forward.
Daniel Scusato, our guest, we really are running out of time. I just want to say this. What does Jonathan Osorio got to do to get on the men's national team here? Like, this is career year he's having, and he's not getting on the team. I can't believe it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, look, the reason that Benito Floro gave was that Will Johnson and Atiba Hutchinson were back in the lineup, so it was unlikely that Osorio was going to play. I mean, I'm willing to give the benefit of the doubt for one camp, you know, for him missing out on one
camp. It's just Belize.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if it's a regular occurrence and he's not on this roster going forward, then maybe we can start throwing some questions in Floro's direction.
Thanks, Dan. We really appreciate it. And, well, let's hope Canada moves on further through this World Cup qualifying.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for taking the time, gentlemen.
Really appreciate Daniel Scusato and James Montague joining us on the show today. European Football Weekly. I'm Dan Riccio. That is Thomas Michalakos. And, God, I hope Canada really figures something out here and at least makes a World Cup someday.
At least in our lifetime, please.
Another Gold Cup run. Like, I was going when they won the Gold Cup in 2000. I was absolutely loving it. And like everybody, I was like, yeah, we're turning this around, baby. We're moving on. We're going to make World Cups. We're going to do great things.
15 years later?
And I'm still
same old story.
Still remembering the 06 World Cup for Italy more than I have remembered anything for Canada since the 2000 Gold Cup, other than the 8-1 loss to Honduras. But yeah, on to bigger and better things right now. Hopefully Canada gets to being bigger and better one of these days in the world football. But the transfer window, finally it's closed. The silly season is done with. And we can now review the silly season. So you took out a couple of interesting takes from the transfer window and how money was spent. So what is it you came up with there, Thomas?
Yeah, well, I noticed something by the CIES Football Observatory. Don't ask me who or what, but apparently it's very...
Yeah, they're actually really well known. Yeah,
yeah, they're really well known. But I don't understand how their numbers are going. But it's funny, they were saying the big five, the top five overpriced players, they're inflated players, and the best five purchases. And guess who's first? You know who's first? Anthony Martial. I mean, $50 million for a 19-year-old, not so much. But second on that list, Kevin De Bruyne. Apparently, his estimated value was only €47 million, and €74 million was paid. But that was the funny part about that is you see a lot of a City there. The number one best transfer given a value, Raheem Sterling. This is what throws this whole whatever you want to call it up in arms.
Look,
because how does that make sense?
Just because you're upset that Raheem Sterling made the big move from Liverpool to Manchester City and he got what he wanted, you know, doesn't mean that it was a bad buy. Like,
it's a bad buy.
We've talked about it on the show, and yes, it's
price,
way
price.
Too much money for Manchester City to pay, at least in our opinion. But so far, so good. It's working beautifully so far for Manchester City. They're top of the league. They haven't lost a beat. They are just, they're rolling along.
Look, I don't want to say anything bad about this list because a lot of people worked hard on this list. So you know what? Kudos to the hard work. However,
yeah,
it's great fodder because second on the list of the best signing value,
yep,
dollar for dollar, well, euro for euro, your boy, your favorite name in football.
Mario Balotelli?
No. You've said it before.
Mapu-Yanga Mbiwa.
Number two.
Oh, no way.
Yes, number two. And Robin Van Persie, number three. So this list, I don't know which way to go. I just thought it was interesting
about. Those were bargain buys, those two. So
very bargain buys.
And hey, Italy, for once, has spent a lot of money in... I don't know where that came from, but they have, right?
Yeah, because looking on the list, there's a lot of players that are like it's unbelievable. Stevan Jovetic is on the list, great signing. Mattia Destro's on the list, another great signing. They're saying value euro for euro, but then you look and you got Di Maria who's on third on the list, and then you see all the crazy, you know, inflated prices going on. I just found it was very interesting. You could see it on Bleacher Report if you want to get a closer look at it. Just go into the world football section.
Yeah, it's interesting. And there's a lot of different stuff that came out of this transfer window. I think Martial, I read somewhere that if he ever finishes in the top three of Ballon d'Or,
yeah,
his transfer will move up to like $90 million or something like that.
Well, that will never happen.
Well, you never know.
I'm pretty confident I could put on some money. I'm more confident that won't happen than Iceland winning the Euros. So,
and you thought Greece would never win a major tournament
either.
So,
true.
Who's the wrong one here?
And
you also
money.
Took Manchester City out of the top four in the Premier League.
I'm still sticking with that. I'm still sticking with it.
Of course you are, because you're not smart. Well,
what a way
that's
to end.
That's a great way to end the show this week.
For you, not me.
Can't wait for club football to come back.
Please.
Serie A, European Football Weekly, English Premier League, Bundesliga, it's all coming up on Sportsnet this weekend, and we'll be here right next Monday to be back and reviewing it all once again. For Thomas Michalakos, for producer Emil Delich, James Montague, and Daniel Squizzato, this has been European Football Weekly.